and wisdom. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So what's going on here in this passage in Isaiah? Is this just a bunch of euphemisms for sex? The answer is no, it's not. Isaiah is not talking about sex at all. He's talking about agriculture. And he's talking to a people in the book of Isaiah, or in the time period of the Bible. He's talking to a people who are disregarding God's wisdom, disregarding God's instruction in their lives. And as a result, they're about to be sent into exile. So it's kind of the big punishment in the Old Testament. They're not being faithful. They're not listening to God's wisdom. And so they're going to be punished by getting kicked out of the promised land. And so as Isaiah is talking to them, warning them, telling them to turn and repent, he is reminding them of the wisdom of God. And reminding them that God's wisdom extends to every detail of their lives. And so even down to how do you treat this particular seed? And what do you do when you plant this type of crop? God has particular wisdom for all of those things. And so if God has very specific designs for seeds, dill, cumin, grain, barley, should we not also expect him to have very specific designs for something so profound as sex? And then, shouldn't we expect that same design to be wonderful in counsel, just as verse 29 says, to be excellent in wisdom? If God cares about how crops flourish, then how much more does he care about how his people flourish? And so that's kind of our kind of base text as we get in. God has wisdom for us. He has wisdom for all of life. And in particular, he has wisdom on the subject of sex. But if we survey the world around us, and as we look at places where kind of currently where God's wisdom is being most disregarded, we can't help but note that sex is one of the clearest places where culturally we have a rebellion against God's wisdom, especially in our current cultural moment. Now, before we even go a step further, we're just going to ask ourselves a very basic question. What is sex? So if I were to ask you to write down, like right now, hey, write down the definition of sex, what would you write down? I'm not necessarily asking you to do that, but if you were, what would you write down? So kind of just be thinking about that. And even as you think about it, you might think, well, that's kind of tricky because sex as a word is used in multiple ways in our society, right? So if you had to write down a definition, you'd have to say, well, what do you mean when you say sex? Are you talking about sex as anatomy, like male, female, gender? Or are you talking about sex as activity? And the answer is yes. Okay, we're talking about both of those in this class. We're talking about sex as anatomy and sex as activity. So we think about an anatomy. Historically, the term sex has always really just been a sort of a synonym for gender, right? So sex is the biological category of male or female that corresponds with your genitals. Okay, like I said, I'll just be direct when I have to be, okay? And so your sex is the result of your genetic composition. So in one way, that's what sex is. It's a bodily reality or even like a body part reality. So sex, maleness or femaleness, it's established at a child's conception. It's written throughout the body down to the cellular level. So when we're talking about sex as anatomy, yes, we're talking about body parts, but even more granular, even more fundamental, even more microscopic than our body parts, right? So sex has to do with our entire biological composition, down to our chromosomes, down to our gametes, okay? And speaking of gametes, sex is also activity, right? So it's anatomy and it's activity. And so when we use that word, often we use the word sex. Like if you're writing down the definition, you might have thought, like the definition I'm writing down is thinking about sex as an activity. And so in our present culture, kind of the use of that word sex has kind of been expanded to include really any kind of erotic genital activity. You didn't expect to hear that phrase probably tonight, but there it is. So sex, kind of broadly speaking, is anything that really fits in that category, culturally at least, of any sort of erotic genital activity. But that's a lot of times where people's minds go when you hear, what is sex? And I would say that's probably my first impulse. If you say, define that word, I would define it in terms of just sexual intercourse, right? But culturally, it means more than that, generally speaking, okay? And so, but essentially what this class is, it's 10 weeks of us trying to biblically explain how Christians are supposed to understand sex, both as anatomy and as activity. So we're going to look at what the Bible teaches about sex, sex as a biological reality, and sex as something we do with our bodies that God has given to us. And so that's what we're looking at when we're talking about this big class on sex. And so if we go back to that opening question, what is sex? What I would like to do is kind of give you like a working definition that sort of incorporates both of these things, anatomy and activity, and shows how those two things are connected. This definition is actually going to come from a book called When Harry Became Sally, which is a book about transgender kind of stuff. It's by a guy named Ryan Anderson. Ryan Anderson is a Catholic scholar, but the definition you have there on your note sheet is from this book. If you were looking to buy this book, you could not buy it at Amazon because they've banned it from Amazon. So because it's not pro-transgender in the way that Amazon is pro-transgender. But Ryan Anderson, really thoughtful, wrote a lot of stuff on marriage kind of right before Obergefell came out. His work is worth reading, especially if you wanted to dive more into this. But this is where this definition is going to come from. So again, what we're trying to do is just a definition of sex that kind of includes both these ideas of anatomy and activity kind of joined together. So sex, it's on your note sheet there. Sex, in terms of male or female, is identified by the organization of an organism for sexually reproductive acts. So let that sink in for just a minute. So it's identified by the organization of an organism for sexually reproductive acts. Sex as status, male or female, is a recognition of the organization of a body that has the ability to engage in sex as an act. So more simply than being identified on the basis of such organization, sex is a coherent concept only on the basis of that organization. So the fundamental conceptual distinction between a male and female is the organism's organization for sexual reproduction. Okay, so what he's trying to say, let me just kind of parse that out a little bit. What Anderson's trying to show us is two things, that sex is a biological reality. It's unchangeable, and it is complete with a particular anatomy that a human is born with, right? And then, two, that biological reality, it fundamentally structures our entire body, our entire personhood, toward that end of sexual reproduction, okay? Does that make sense, kind of what's going on there? So the type of body you have determines what type of sexual how you can reproduce sexually. And so that tells you if you're male or if you're female. So your body parts are not just incidental, right? But they fundamentally reveal your genetic makeup, as we said earlier, from chromosomes to gametes, right? And so your body is holistically categorized along the binary lines of male and female. So you have a sexed body, meaning like male or female, right? And that dictates the way in which you are to engage in sex as an activity. And that would fall in the lines of toward biological reproduction or sexual reproduction, okay? So that's what kind of Anderson's trying to do for us, trying to just very clearly help us think through what is male, what is female. Those things aren't changeable. And then how do we know how those designs work? Well, it works toward the end of sexual reproduction. Now, at the beginning, at the outset of this class, you might think, this seems completely unnecessary. Why would we need a definition that, not simple, but you know, it's not really a simple definition, but why would we, this seems too basic to take up any of our time. But I would tell you, just a look at the wider culture reveals that's not the case. Okay, and so let's just take a quick pop quiz. And I've got all the questions for you. You may have already read ahead on here, but I'm going to ask you 10 hypothetical questions that pertain to matters of sexuality. And the way I want to phrase the question is this way. What biblical text would you use in the following situation? Okay, so that's kind of how we're thinking about it. So what biblical text would you use to respond to the following 10 situations? Because remember, God's wisdom is particular. His wisdom is specific. His word has given us everything we need to know for life and godliness. And that would include these 10 questions here. So what biblical text would you use, number one, to respond to a friend who is considering moving in with her boyfriend? You got to just think right now, like, where would I go? What would be the text? Question number two. What biblical text would you use to respond to your sibling who believes that God made him to experience same-sex attraction and therefore it is okay for him to act on it? And so he's not just saying, I was born this way, but I was born by God this way. How do you respond? What biblical text would you respond with? Question number three, what biblical text would you respond with to a parent of a child? And the parent suggests that their five-year-old son is actually a girl trapped in a boy's body. What text might you pick? Number four, what text would you use to respond to a couple who tells you that they watch pornography together in order to aid their own sex life? Question number five, what biblical text might you go to respond to either a single or a married sister in Christ who is considering a breast enhancement surgery? Number six, what would you use to respond to your 12-year-old son who asks you why masturbation is sinful? Again, all the words, just going to use them all. So hope you're not too uncomfortable with that. Question number seven, what text might you use to respond to a friend who asks you to be a bridesmaid at her same-sex wedding ceremony? So you're thinking about, how do I respond to this person? What texts are you thinking about going to? Or to respond to number eight, your own father who expresses his desire to divorce your mother to be with another woman because that woman is who he was supposed to be with all along. What would you use to respond to that? Number nine, what text might you use to respond to your supervisor at work who insists that you refer to other employees' preferred pronouns, whether that's they or Z or even he for someone who you know is a biological female? Or question number 10, what text might you use to respond to a college friend of yours who comes out as a lesbian and who's in an active relationship, but she says that she is now closer to God than she's ever been before? So those 10 questions obviously are complex issues. But not one of them is an unreal scenario. Every one of those 10 I have experienced either personally in my own family or through people in this church. Every one of those 10 have come across, you know, my attention in the last 10 years. Just quick show of hands. How many of you have experienced three of these in some capacity? Like somewhat close to you? Okay, a lot of folks. So, like we said, these are not unreal issues, right? And they're complex, they're real life issues, and we, as God's people, must have answers. And so when we encounter scenarios like this, we need more than the phrase, well, this is what I think about that. No. What we need to do, we need to be able to say with all the fullness and grace of grace and truth that comes in Jesus Christ, well, this is what God actually says about that. But even as we want to be the people who know what God says about that, we don't just want to be the people who have answers and arguments for everything. The goal is not just to have a text, but also to have love for these people, right? The goal is not just to, you know, own the libs, right? But to display a better way of Jesus Christ. So in short, we want to adopt the posture that Jesus adopts, right? So God's word and God's spirit, they've been given to us that we would know the truth, and we'd be able to speak the truth in love. So even as we think about these matters and think about them biblically and think about how do we respond to people in these scenarios, we're not just trying to argue, we're also trying to persuade, right? We're trying to tell the truth in a way that points people to Jesus. Sam Alberry is a pastor who's intentionally celibate, experiences same-sex attraction himself. But Sam Alberry has said, people don't care if something is true if they don't believe it's good. People don't care if it's something is true if they don't believe it's good. So even as we try to discern what does God's word say that's true, how do we tell it to people in a way that shows them it's good, that it's for their flourishing, and that the beauty of Christ is better than whatever else they would trade him for? So that's going to be one of the goals of this class, to show God's designs as good, but also to display Jesus and his yoke. And his yoke is easy and his burden as light, even as the text we used in our greeting this morning. And so kind of part three there, as we think about getting our bearings, trying to figure out where we are. So how did we arrive at such a moment, a cultural moment, regarding the topic of sex? How did we venture so far from the sexual norms that are explained in the Bible, or even maybe the ones you grew up with, and so far from these norms that really for virtually all of human history, they were kind of understood and agreed upon by virtually everyone. How do we move this far away? And it's here that I want to rely on kind of two works and really summarize a portion of two works by a guy named Carl Truman. Carl Truman is a church historian and theologian. He's in his probably mid-50s. He's from England. He teaches here in the United States, but he has two books that I would recommend to you. I think I have them listed right there on your notes. But this is the long version of the book and the short version of the book. They're both good, but one is longer than the other. Okay, so let that help you if you want to pick out one of these to read. But the longer one's called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, and the shorter one is called Strange New World. And like I said, it's kind of like the 200-page version of the 400-page book. But Truman, what he's doing in this book is he's trying to figure out, how did we get to this point, and what kind of philosophical ideas, that maybe ideas that you haven't heard, but you've heard the downstream effect of these ideas. And our culture has kind of been impacted by all these things. But you have this on your note sheet right under those two books. But Truman offers this great thought experiment to help us kind of see how far we've moved, really in just like a generation or two's time when it comes to our cultural understanding of sex. But he says this, the sentence, "I am a woman trapped in a man's body," would have been nonsense to my grandfather. Had it been uttered by a patient to a doctor in the mid-20th century, the doctor would have almost certainly responded that the patient had a psychiatric problem and that his mind needed to be treated so as to bring his feelings in line with his physical body. Well, today, the doctor is more likely to respond that the problem is such that the patient's body needs to be brought into alignment with those inner feelings. Indeed, were a doctor to respond in the earlier fashion today, he might well find himself subject to legal action. What has changed in our society and in the social imaginary to bring this new situation about? I think that's a great question, a great way to even pose the question, right? So like, how did we get from where a lot of us even grew up to where we are now in terms of just the culture's understanding of sex? And like I said, his whole book is really trying to kind of explore the cascading effects of certain philosophical ideas and technological developments that have gotten us to this point. But in the first chapter of the book, he points out three things, and it's here where I'm going to do kind of a lot of summary of his argument because I think it's spot on. It's really helpful. But you see the next thing on your notes, kind of three key ideas that he traces out that help us understand, how did we get from believing that marriage is between a man and a woman to a man could actually be trapped inside a woman's body, and we need to change the body to make it match what they feel inside. Okay, so three key ideas. The first idea he calls expressive individualism that's rooted in the modern self. Okay, there's a few quotes in this next part of the thing that I'll read to you, just kind of help you understand what he's saying. But essentially with this idea of expressive individualism rooted in the modern self. So modern society has moved to an understanding of the self as this real me that lives deep inside of me and shapes me and directs my happiness and fulfillment. So the real me is not what you're looking at, but it's this thing that's inside of me. And that real me is kind of the authority in my life, right? The real me is not about my relationship to other people, my obligations to other people. No, the real me is this identity that I create. I feel it inwardly and I live it outwardly. Like, you can't tell me what to feel. You can't tell me what's true, but the real me dictates that. The only authority that I have to answer to, that the modern self has to answer to, is the authority of my own inner feelings. So it's my inner feelings, right? If my inner feelings are that important for my identity, then I have to express my inner feelings for me to be authentic. All right. Whatever I feel inwardly, I have to actually live outwardly. Right? Nothing outside of me can tell me who I am. I determine who I am. So not even my body can determine who I am, but this thing inside of me determines it, right? So that's kind of this idea that Truman is teasing out, right? That's the idea of expressive individual. My inner self, the real me, is the ultimate authority, and I must live that out, okay? And so Truman says that this turn toward just a kind of a widespread acceptance of this idea of expressive individualism that's rooted in the modern self, then you got that, and that's got this backdrop on top of that of the sexual revolution that kind of combines these two things and has progressed us forward toward our understanding of sex. So part one is that the modern self, this inner me, is kind of the real authority in my life. I have to listen to it and do whatever it tells me for me to be happy, right? But then you pair that with the sexual revolution. And by sexual revolution, so that's number two on the note sheet there. sexual revolution, I don't just mean, and Truman doesn't just mean, kind of loosening of sexual moral boundaries, right, to include more forms of sexual expression, right? So, for instance, the sexual revolution is not just that homosexuality went from being illegal to now being legal. No, but the distinctiveness of the sexual revolution is how normalized the sexual practices that once were illegal have now become normal. That's what I mean by normalized, right? So it's not just that we are accepting more sexual practices, but we're kind of all expected to accept all sexual practices, specifically the ones that used to be forbidden. Okay, so that's kind of the hallmark of the sexual revolution. So Truman writes this, kind of the next long quote there on your notes. It's the bottom right on page 2, and it's going to spill over onto page 3. But he says this. It's not the fact, for example, that modern, it's not the fact, I'm sorry, for example, modern people engage in gay sex or look at sexually explicit material while earlier generations did not, that constitutes the sexual revolution. It's not just these changes, right? But it's that gay sex and the use of pornography no longer involve the same shame and social stigma that they once did. Indeed, they have come to be regarded as normal part of our mainstream culture. In short, the sexual revolution does not simply represent a growth in the routine transgression of sexual codes or even a modest expansion of the boundaries of what is and is not acceptable sexual behavior. Not at all. Rather, it is the repudiation of the very idea of such codes in their entirety. Right? It's not just we can do more stuff, but it's why did we even have any rules to begin with? Right? Keeps going. It says more than that. It has come in certain areas such as that of homosexuality and transgenderism, to require the positive repudiation of traditional sexual mores to the point where belief in or maintenance of such views has come to be seen as ridiculous and even as a sign of serious mental or moral deficiency. So he's saying it's not just that we're allowed to do more stuff, but if you hold to a sexual ethic that's taught in the Bible, you're the one who's immoral. You're the one who's crazy. You're the one who has damaging things to say to the rest of society. He keeps going. And to understand this, we need to see the sexual revolution as a particularly sharp manifestation of the characteristics of expressive individualism. So if the individual's inner identity is defined by sexual desire, then he or she must be allowed to act on that desire in order to be an authentic person. Because that's kind of a lot of material, a lot of quotes being said there. But if the key to the modern self is to live out your inner feelings, and if your sexual desires are so central to your real self, then you must be able to live out and act out your sexual desires, and the rest of society should accept that. If they're not, they're hateful and bigoted, right? So that's kind of part one, part two. Part one is this modern self, the expressive individuals, and part two is kind of the rapid shifting and what is acceptable sexual practice. But then the third part is this idea called the social imaginary. And I realize even as we get to this, like, what? That sounds so strange, right? But it's a term coined by a philosopher named Charles Taylor. And it's a weird phrase because when we use the word imaginary, we use it as an adjective, right? But he's using it as a noun, right? But this term that he has coined, that Charles Taylor's coined, it's there in your notes, but if you kind of succinct definition of it, he says this, the social imaginary is this common understanding which makes possible common practices and a widely shared sense of legitimacy. Okay, the social imaginary is that common understanding which makes possible certain common practices and a widely shared sense of legitimacy. So it gives it a widely shared sense of legitimacy. So I'm going to try to explain this, okay? And I'm going to use another quote from Carl Truman, and he's going to explain it in terms of kind of thinking about sexuality, okay? Because you might be thinking, I don't understand what you mean by the social imaginary. Took me a while too, and you've only had a couple of minutes to get used to it. So I'm going to read this quote, and hopefully it kind of, oh, I see what he's saying here, okay? So let's read this next long quote. So Carl Truman says it like this. The reason society thinks about sex the way it does is the result of the confluence of a host of factors. So the pill, and he means the birth control pill, the pill made it cheap and easy to separate sex from procreation. In short, it made sex as recreation far more of a practical option than it had been before.
The advent of Playboy and then Cosmopolitan magazine and mainstream culture presented promiscuity as a cool, attractive lifestyle for men and women alike. And then the rise of no-fault divorce reduced marriage just to a sentimental bond. And then you have the rhetoric of feminism asserted a woman's control over their own bodies and their sexuality. And then the internet massively expanded the accessibility of pornography. And as more and more people used it, the social stigma that was traditionally carried with it was diminished. Then you've got soap operas and sitcoms, even commercials that present sex as a cost-free pastime. And then if there's a thing to underline, it's this next sentence, right? The list goes on and on, but the picture is clear. A complex set of factors from philosophy to technology to pop culture, they shape the way that we intuitively think about sex. Indeed, they shape the way we think about the world in general and our place within it. And that is why it's so helpful thinking about our situation in terms of the social imaginary. Okay, so the way a society thinks about anything comes from a multifaceted combination of things. Okay, so in terms of our collective social thinking about sex, everything from the way a sitting president talks about sex or is reported to have engaged in sex, to the way that the most popular television shows depict people in sexual relationships, or the songs that we listen to, or the legal policies that are put into place by state or federal legislators. All of these things are shaping the way in which we build our understanding of sex. Because there's a lot of different things combining together that are moving us down the line to where we are in our current understanding of sex. And I'll just put this practically, kind of like my own life. Okay, so someone like me, and not just me, but a lot of you around me, right? You grew up with an understanding of sex that was being shaped by a married president who was having a sexual relationship with an intern while on the job. Okay, so that was coming at you and shaping the way you're thinking about sex. You combine that with a television show like Friends. How many watch Friends? Like back in the day, not just now. Now it's awful, right? If you were to watch, like, it's not funny. It's like yeah, but anyway. But you combine that with the idea of what's being presented in Friends. This normalizing of casual sex, a rotation of sexual partners among a friend group, even the use of pornography. And so a show like Friends, wildly popular, shaping the cultural kind of imagination about sex. And what show came on after Friends? Does anybody remember? Will and Grace. And Will and Grace is about homosexuality in large part. So you got Friends and Will and Grace and, of course, numerous other shows that are all kind of pushing the envelope in terms of what's socially acceptable in terms of sex, and we're taking that in, whether we realize it or not. You combine that with, if you're like me, I can't remember if it was middle school or high school, but the song Yeah by Usher. You didn't expect to hear that, right? But even when I heard it in high school, I remember thinking, this has got to be the most vulgar, sexually explicit song that I had ever heard. But you listened to it on the way to youth group, right? And then you sang Hillsong, and then you went back, and you maybe listened to Usher again, right? But that, you're taking in these words, and what's it doing? It's shaping your own understanding of sex. And not just yours, but everybody that's listening to that song. And you can't escape it, right? You hear it at the mall, you hear it wherever. You combine that with the reality of parents divorcing, even parents of like kids in your church, or even your own parents. And so you kind of combine all those things for me as a teenager. All of this is happening. Some of it's avoidable, some of it's not. But all these factors can combine together to form, not just in my own head, but all of our society's heads, because we're all reading the same news, we're hearing the same songs, seeing the same shows, experiencing the same family dynamics played out in our communities. And all of these things are making us, forming our common understanding of sex in our minds. It's making us move from seeing some things as, that's not good, that's not right, to, oh, that's normal, that's legitimate, that's what we should expect in terms of sexuality. So things that were once forbidden and unthinkable become thinkable and normalized and even championed over time. So that's what this idea of the social imaginary kind of applied to sexuality shows us, that it's not just a couple of ideas by philosophers that have kind of trickled down, but it's a cascading effect of lots and lots of things that kind of brought us to where we are and our kind of unconscious understanding about sex. And we kind of walk through all that and say, well, why go through all those difficult to understand ideas? Truman's point in all that is, if we're going to respond to our times, we have to understand our times. We have to understand how we got from A to B, or like A to Z, wherever we are now. We have to understand how we got here so that we can rightly respond. That's what we're going to try to do in this class. We're going to try to understand what the Bible says, and we're going to also try to understand what our culture is saying and what our culture is kind of where it's gone in terms of sexuality. And so, and then even as we walk through it, there might be some areas that we will have to kind of correct in our own selves, in our own thinking, where we may have kind of uncritically imbibed too much of this social imaginary when it comes to sex, right? And then we'll try to think about how to respond. And so I hope you noticed that kind of in the way I even asked the questions in the pop quiz. Every time I was, how do you respond? What would you respond with in this situation? Because that's what we're thinking. We're not just trying to have the answers. We're thinking, how do we respond to hurting people or people that are convinced of something that is going to lead to their destruction? And then how can we respond to them in love and in truth? So thanks for walking through that philosophical journey there with me. And then just a couple more things we'll do tonight. So kind of part four there is defining the terms. And so when I was in seminary, I had a professor who always stressed the importance of defining the terms. And so it's like, hey, we're talking about this topic. This is what I mean when I'm saying this word. Do you understand me to mean that same thing? And so it's really important that we kind of define the terms. And so what I've tried to do is give you some really short definitions of lots of words, maybe words that you're already perfectly familiar with, but maybe some that you're not as familiar with. So I'm just going to kind of go through them quickly as we have time, and then kind of talk about the rest of what the course will look like, and then we'll be wrapped up. Okay, so that's the kind of the remainder of our time. Okay, so just a couple of definitions. We've already done this, but we'll repeat it. So if we define the term sex, so this biological category of male or female, and it corresponds with one's own with the organization of the organism for sex or reproductive acts. Okay, so male, female, made in a certain way to reproduce in a certain way, and God has given the gift of sex to that end. Okay, definition number two, gender, and there's no like real order to these. So if you're thinking like, is this ABC order? No, it's just the order I came up with. So gender, historically, it was always just a synonym for sex, right? But now it's become increasingly thought about differently because of definition number three, gender theory. So gender theory is this idea that we can have a gender identity that's different than our biological sex, right? Gender theory is challenging the idea that we have a fixed sexual identity. And so as Christians, we would say, we reject this idea of gender theory, okay? Because it's built upon a complete departure from God's created order, okay? Number four, binary. And so when you use that word binary, it's simply this historical understanding of sex and gender that's falling into two categories, male and female. And so those who would be proponents of gender theory, we kind of use that word binary as a negative thing. Hey, you're just thinking in terms of binary, you're old-fashioned, you're bigoted. There's more than just male and female. There's more than that, right? But we would say the Bible's teaching that binary is actually the way it works. There's male and there's female. Definition number five, LGBTQIA. Those are letters you're all familiar with at this point. Oh, and the plus sign. You probably all know all these, but lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, intersex, asexual, and then the plus is anything else that's outside the bounds of cisgendered heteronormativity. You say, what's that? Wait till number 13. We'll get there. Okay. Number six, heterosexual. So that would be those attracted to the opposite sex. Homosexual would be those attracted to the same sex, and kind of a separate category underneath that as we follow kind of the LGBT. So lesbian referring to a female attracted to females. Gay referring to a male attracted to males. Bisexual would be those attracted to both sexes. Transgender, and then we're going to have a couple of kind of sub-definitions. Transgender, we kind of broadly say anyone who feels dissatisfaction with their own biological sex. Okay, so those people who are kind of proponents of transgenderism, it's not just a man presenting as a woman. That would be kind of the far extreme of that. But they would say transgenderism is anybody who feels any sort of dissatisfaction with the body that they are in. Okay, but kind of sub-definition of that, gender dysphoria. Be this term that's kind of a psychological distress that stems from the feeling of incongruence with one's own bodily sex. We might use that phrase, feeling like you're a man trapped in a woman's body. Or the kind of the further part of that, transsexual would be a biologically normal or healthy man or woman who's not intersex. We'll get to that in a second. Who lives, that's a typo there, lives, we have an S on the end, lives as a member of the opposite sex. So a trans man or a trans woman would be the language there. So a trans man, you got to follow me, trans man is a woman made by God as a woman presenting as a man. Okay, trans man. That's kind of the language that's used there. Number 10, queer would be rejecting either male or female systems altogether. Hey, I don't have anything to do with that binary. I'm my own thing, entirely different, right? So that would kind of be the queer ideology. Intersex, number 11. So this is the kind of the category of at birth, a child is born with ambiguous genitalia. Another term for that would be a disorder of sexual development. There are varying degrees of this. So if you kind of read more into it, what you need to know is that they are exceedingly rare. So about 2 in 10,000 births have some sort of disruption in the sexual development in utero, and it results in some sort of label of intersex. If you read into it, there's all these different kind of subcategories that make it clear as you kind of get into the science of it. No, that person disordered in this kind of chromosomal thing, but the rest of their bodily composition toward reproduction is clearly female, clearly male. So it's not like there's this third category of person called intersex. God made male, female, Adam and Eve, and then an intersex. That's not what's going on here. But intersex is just kind of this disorder of sexual development in utero that affects 2 in about 10,000 people. Okay, so that's what that is. Asexual, so that would be letter A of the LGBTQIA. Asexual would be those who claim to be attracted to neither sex or anyone else. And then number 13, this is the phrase pointed to earlier, but cisgender would be a non-transgendered person. Because the word cis means on the same side as. So the use of this word implies that if a person's mind lines up with their body, they're kind of privileged, right? And so we as Christians, I'll just say, we kind of reject that terminology of cisgendered. We say that's unhelpful. Because we kind of say, like, kind of adding something on top of the male-female distinction that God has made, and that's the case for all people. He's kind of layer the cisgendered thing on this, kind of adding this kind of additional language that's unhelpful and unnecessary. Number 14, heteronormativity would be kind of a word that's used negatively to refer to how heterosexual relationships are accepted in a society as the normal pattern of sexual relationships. Okay, so if someone says, you're a cisgendered, a heteronormative person, they're telling you, like, you're following the Bible, but they're saying that's bad, right? That's a negative thing, that you would be a person who is attracted to the opposite sex and are comfortable with the body that the Lord has given you, okay? So that's number 14. Number 15 is kind of the last couple of things, kind of as you think about kind of transgender stuff in particular. So gender reassignment or gender confirmation surgery, that'd be kind of the typical sex change through, as it's called. That's why it's in quotation marks, because you can't actually change sex. But sex change through surgery and hormone therapy, transforming a man or woman into what looks like the opposite sex in some varying capacity. And then number 16, the word androgyny, which is the blurring of gender roles, kind of the combination of masculine and feminine characteristics into an ambiguous form. Okay, so kind of getting rid of kind of male-femaleness and just kind of combining all things into one kind of amorphous blob. Now, you may find that exhausting, and that's not even an exhaustive list, right? But what you need to notice here, and just kind of put one last quote before you, what you need to notice here is that the entire gender theory revolution, and really in a large part of the sexual revolution, is dependent upon language instead of reality. It's dependent upon language instead of reality. This is a book by one other Catholic person, a Catholic lady named Abigail Favale. I may not be saying that right, but Wilkins could correct me. He's familiar. She's a Catholic scholar, works at Notre Dame, went to college and graduate school overseas as a pretty committed feminist, but then converted to Catholicism when she kind of realized the hypocrisy or the kind of disconnects within feminism. But she has this quote, and it's there on your notes, but it's kind of just thinking about this language and how really the whole language of of trying to move past God's design of male and female and to move into like these new realms of transgender and different ideologies. I mean, she's showing us it's really just an artifice built on language. And that's why the language piece is so important to those who are kind of in that camp. But she says this, accepting that a man is really a woman and vice versa requires effort, a conscious exertion of thought, because this cuts against biology and common sense. Since the gender paradigm is not based on concrete reality, perpetuating this framework requires careful policing of thought and language. Today's concept of gender identity is not based on material reality. This means that the construct of gender identity must be continually buttressed by language in order to appear true. This requires not only a self-declaration of gender, but a declaration that's echoed by everyone else. If gender identity only exists in language, our language must be manipulated, or else the whole thing falls apart. That's really what's at stake in the battle over pronouns. It's our understanding of reality itself. So eventually in the class, we'll get to the point where we try to think about, for example, how we should go along with the pronoun language game. But for now, I just want to establish how the terms and the way those terms are used matter, especially if you're on the side, kind of the shifting gender paradigm, because really the terms, the language is all you have. You have no material reality to build on. So you play with words. And so that's why the words we use matter, and the way we define the terms matter. And so that's why we want to spend time defining the terms. In the last part of our night, I just want to kind of show us where we're going, so kind of charting a course. So as we move through this semester, and we try to think about what the Bible teaches about sex as anatomy and as activity, and then what the culture says about sex, both as anatomy and activity, and in terms of identity, we're thinking, what all do we need to know, and where all do we need to engage? And so we just walked through the course introduction. Next week, we will kind of just explore a long look at Genesis 2, 1 and 2, and what it's like to be made in God's image as male and female, and really what God's vision for sexuality looks like. So that's next week, and then we'll have a week off for a prayer meeting, and then on February the 12th, we'll do a night on complementarianism and egalitarianism. And so think about God making man and women in specific ways, then what does it look like to live that out according to the ways God has made us? Okay, so that's on February 12th. Real quick, that's on the night of the Super Bowl. So I expect this crowd maybe to be thinner, but we're also going to make a change about that. We're going to have class starting at 4:30 that night. We're not going to have dinner that night. I'm going to tell you now. So it's class from 4:30 to 5:15, and then we know that you probably have people you were hoping to get together with. Great. Go and do that after class if you come to class. Okay, so just know that that's what's going on that night. We'll make sure we email that out to you, but I'm just telling you now. So that's on February 12th. Then we'll come back and we'll do 2 weeks in a row on homosexuality. So the first, we really just kind of think, what does the Bible say about homosexuality when we trade out one sex being of the male-female relationship, like if we trade out male for female or vice versa. And then kind of the second part of that, how do Christians respond to an issue that seems to have moved into total acceptance in our culture? How do we respond to that? So that's 2 weeks on homosexuality, and then we'll do 2 weeks on transgenderism. So we'll kind of try to answer the question, is it possible for a wise God to have placed someone with a male soul and a female body? Does the Bible allow for something like that? And then we'll kind of ask, how do we respond in truth in this new frontier of transgender ideology? Okay, so that's 2 weeks on that. That's March 12th, March 19th. And then we have like a 3-week break. Okay, so front half of spring break, no equip. Second half of spring break is Palm Sunday. There's a prayer meeting. And then the third week after that is Easter. So we won't have equip any of those three nights. So you get a nice 3-week break, recharge your batteries, and come back and get ready to talk about pornography and masturbation. And so according to the Bible, can a person have sex with themselves? Okay, this is a simple way to ask the question. We'll spend time that night speaking about that. So that's April 16th. April 23rd, we'll talk about extramarital sex and celibacy. So according to the Bible, can we faithfully remove sex from this context of one flesh union? Can we take it out of the marriage bed? And if not, then what's there for us? Like, if we're not allowed to do that, like, how can I be a faithfully single person and live a celibate lifestyle? Is that attainable? So we'll speak about that. And then April the 30th, we will do a Q&A. And I am terrified. So we may not. We may just have a party like the kids' equip classes do. It's like everybody gets a merit badge for sitting through this class. So that's what we're looking at. And it's almost 6:30, so we're going to dismiss in just a moment. But I'll try each night to reference any books and kind of hold them out to you. Oh, one thing I did mean to say on this Carl Truman book, both the Carl Truman books, if you're like a library card holder and you use Hoopla, the audiobook of both of these is on Hoopla, so it's a free resource, obviously, and it's read by the author. So it's always better when it's read by the author, especially when the author's British, right? So so you can listen to that if that's something you'd be interested in doing. I'm going to pray. If you have any questions, please come and speak to me. I'll try to build more time or questions on the back end, or maybe I won't. It might be easier if I don't. No, I'll try to build more time in each night to have some time for questions. Thanks for sitting through that walk through. Again, if you have questions, please come ask. We'll put the audio up in some capacity. I'll try to communicate that out, and I'll put the notes up in a PDF form in some capacity that you can access. Okay, I'll pray, and then we'll go get our kids. God, we thank you for the truth of your word. We thank you that you are excellent in your counsel, that you're perfect in your wisdom, that you care about our flourishing, and that, Lord, your designs are good. And so, Lord, it's our prayer that you would help us to be a people who believe that, who aren't embarrassed by that, aren't squeamish about these truths, but at the same time who know how to speak about these truths in love to people who are in rebellion against these truths, rebelling against you ultimately, and who are in pain in ways that they may not fully comprehend or understand. And so we pray that you would help us to be a people that are full of grace and full of truth, even as we engage with these difficult topics. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks, everybody.